Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Welcome to the latest episode of The Shamrock. I'm Pete Sampson, joined as always by my co-host Matt Fortuna, and joining us from somewhere around Greater Los Angeles is Antonio Morales, our USC beat writer at The Athletic. Antonio, thanks for making some time this week. And yeah, it's the first time since this has been a top 25 game in LA since 2006, when it was Brady Quinn versus John David Booty. Things have changed a little bit for both programs, but I don't think there's a program in college football that has changed more in the last 12 months than USC, and we both cover Notre Dame, which would be high on that list. But in terms of the, man, the Lincoln Riley revolution or whatever you want to call it, what has it been like to sort of be on the ground covering it and sort of documenting how a team went from just adrift in college football to suddenly in position to play its way into the college football playoff?
Well, they kind of represent like all the touch points that were like a major topic of discussion all off season. You have the coaching salaries, the rising coaching salaries, and Lincoln's at the forefront of that. You have the transfer portal and just roster movement and everything like that. And they brought in 20 transfers and got rid of 20 more guys, basically processed 20 more guys. The whole coaching staff is new, except for Dante Williams, who you guys remember said USC just ran out of time last year. And then there's the NIL aspect, which like USC is painted as like an NIL boogeyman. But if you ask their fans, they're not doing enough in NIL.
What's NIL? We don't know about that.
Notre Dame's unfamiliar with it.
So they're kind of like just at the forefront of like where this sport is kind of headed, and it's just been interesting to watch that all come together. And it's the most extreme version of it, but obviously it's worked for them.
It's funny you mentioned that, Antonio, because I have a column come out tomorrow looking at a bunch of different things in the coaching kind of carousel, and I had a line in there basically saying there are a lot of ADs who are going to point to what Lincoln Riley did this year at USC and be like, see, we can get good really quick. And it's like, well, it's also the bluest of blue bloods. He's maybe the best coach in the country, certainly on the short list behind Nick Saban, and they're in Los Angeles. I think it's not to take away from what he's done, but he's got a few advantages there that maybe Auburn and some other places will. We all knew he would get this thing turned around. We all know what he's about, what he's made of. I guess, are you surprised it's this soon? Like, they may have the Heisman winner and a college football playoff team come 2 weeks from now.
Definitely. I thought this season was going to be like more of a 9-3 type season. I thought maybe 2023 or 2024. This is before the Big Ten move, but I thought those 2 years were going to be the years where they really kind of took off. And I was just thinking about it earlier today. I don't know what that means if they go to the playoff in year one. Like, how do you view like expectations for next year and everything like that? Because they're going to lose some talented players. Like, the defense is not good this year. And they're going to lose talented players like off of that group for next season. I know that they'll hit the portal hard, but there's not a ton of great defensive players in the portal every year. I think it's easier to get better on offense in the portal. So it's like, how's this going to like change expectations? If you make the playoff this year, like, are people going to be expecting like national title or something next year? When I don't know if that'll be realistic. So I was thinking 9-3. They're already 10-1. So I think they've exceeded expectations, even though I thought the defense was going to look like this. The offense has, you know, led the way.
With the offense, I mean, Matt said, you know, what anyone would have thought, like the idea of Lincoln Riley developing a Heisman Trophy winning quarterback, yeah, totally predictable. But to go 10-1, definitely not. and I think that you and Bruce maybe collaborated on a story last week going to the UCLA game. And I think there was feedback in there about, like, if you took Caleb Williams off USC's roster, maybe they're 6-4, maybe they're 7-3. How, like, do you sort of see it that way? And, like, could you give people a sense of how sort of important and fundamental Caleb Williams is to all the success that's happening with USC right now?
Yeah, I think if they had like Jackson Dart or something, they'd still be like 6-4, like around there, just because Caleb, like, the offensive line is very good. Like, I think people kind of underestimated it going into the season, but I think it's very good. But even when they do have their issues and people do get to Caleb, he just evades all these sacks and gets out of trouble. And he's just like a magician in the pocket. And when he does get on the move, he makes great throws like he did against UCLA, where he threads the needle and it turns into like a 40-yard gain. His top two receivers were out for about 3 weeks, and he played some of the best football of the season in that time. And Travis Dye was out last week, and USC's offense still put up 649 yards, and a lot of that had to do with Caleb. It's like, no matter what's changing around him or what's asked of him, he's playing with a defense that basically like requires him to score like 42, 45 points a game. These are a lot of like heavy asks, and he's kind of met the call pretty much every game this season.
You mentioned the defense, and look, personnel wise, it's not where they want it to be. And yet you look up, they're number one nationally in turnover margin. They forced 24 turnovers on the year, fifth nationally. They got four last week against UCLA, and they need every damn one of them to come out of that game alive. I think earlier in the year, we saw them doing this against Stanford and some other teams and thought this probably isn't sustainable. Eventually, they're going to get a bill passed to, and maybe they did get that in the Utah game. But what is it about Alex Grinch that makes him such a great defense coordinator and gets his players to create such havoc, even when, you know, they're giving up big plays and the yardage numbers are not great? They're still making the plays that end up deciding these games.
I think he's instilled a sense of confidence in these guys that they didn't have last year. I think a lot of the games last year, like once things went bad, they're just really demoralized. So UCLA put up 62 on them last year, and you can see that coming from a mile away, weeks ahead of time, just based off the way they were playing. And this year, even though when things aren't going well for them, they don't hang their heads really. They go out there and make their plays, and honestly, they're one play away from being 11-0 right now. They just didn't get that stop they needed at Utah, but they kind of redeemed themselves for that with that ending against UCLA and coming up with the clinching turnover. So no matter what the struggles are, I think they've just come in with the approach like we're a play, we're a turnover or three plays away from getting off the field, and that's just something they didn't have last year's a team. They just didn't have that belief or that confidence. And I think the defensive line is playing well this season. They get gashed in the run game because Grinch does a lot of slanting, a lot of moving with the defensive line, and you see opposing offenses take advantage of it. But the defensive line gets pressure on quarterbacks, and there's been a few games where you heard it against Oregon State and Utah and even UCLA, where the talk was, this team's just going to physically maul USC. USC like doesn't know what's coming. They're just going to get pounded in the run game. And those teams got their yards, but they never really controlled the line of scrimmage like teams thought they would. And I think that's a credit to USC's defensive line. And that's why Sean Nua, the defensive line coach, is, you know, in the running for the Broyles Award.
I'm interested to sort of double back to their offensive line a little bit, because, I mean, I think the Joe Moore Award semifinalist list came out. USC was on it. Notre Dame was not. That's a big sort of paradigm shift from where these two programs were probably over the last 5-6 years. Where did that line take the biggest step forward? I know they got some help in the transfer portal from Virginia, but like what's been the biggest reason for that improvement? Because I think that they were sort of like beyond underachieving. Like it just was not a good group for a while. And it seems like they actually have some physicality to them now, aided perhaps by their quarterback also having kind of a physical edge too.
Yeah, I think they took a step forward last year. They weren't like a great group, but they were like a good group. They struggled against some of the better pass rushing teams they faced, like Notre Dame, but they were still much better than like I expected and I think everyone else expected. And a lot of those guys came back and now they're a year older. And I think last year's scheme continuity helped. And then this year they brought in Josh Henson from A&M. And Lincoln Riley's air raid, his offense isn't the same as Graham Harrell's air raid, but a lot of the stuff is kind of somewhat similar. So I think these guys are aided in the fact that it's not a ton different with some of the stuff they do as far as offensive line goes. And Josh Henson's just done a really good job developing some of the younger players, because if you would have asked me before the season, I would have told you the first five are fine. Like, they're going to be good, and that's not going to be an issue. But if there's an injury or two, and I think that with the depth isn't there, but they've had an injury or two this season, and they've plugged in guys, and they haven't really missed a beat. Mason Murphy, who's been the starter at left tackle the past couple of games over Bobby Haskins, as a guy who's probably the future of the line at left tackle. And he stepped up and developed really well. Dino Quinones is a reserve guy who stepped up and done really well when he was called upon. So that's been the surprising aspect. And I think it's just the older guys taking another step forward based off of what they showed last year. That's really taken this group to another level.
Antonio, you're from Southern California. You've covered this program for a while. Never quite this good. I don't think you were covering them in the Carroll days, but what's it been like? You always hear the term sleeping giant. Everyone knows about the history of USC. Everyone knows, you know, the swag and how cool it is when they're winning again and all the celebrities are showing up on the sideline. What's it been like, you know, just having a front row seat to this kind of renaissance so quickly? And what's the atmosphere and energy been like? Because I'm sure your inbox and your Twitter mentions were an absolute tire fire the last 4 years, or pretty much since you've been covering them. And that tenor has definitely changed.
Obviously now, I think this fan base, I don't think it's all the way unified, but I think it's more unified than it's been since the tail end of the Pete Carroll era. I think they were a little divided because NCAA sanctions and the Sarkisian hire, the Helton hire, you know, those not going the way they wanted and those searches not going the way they wanted, divided the fan base a bit. But I think Lincoln Riley is getting everyone more unified again. And you know, the atmosphere has been very positive. And you know, I wanted to see during the season, like, what, like, when would like the honeymoon phase end? But they're 10-1, so it's still going pretty strong. And to me, I thought, you know, they're 9-1, like entering the UCLA game. I was like, but that season would take a much different light if they lost to like UCLA and Notre Dame. But they beat UCLA, so I think everybody's really, really happy around here. And the fact they're in the mix for the playoff, obviously, they're believing again. And I think they're just happy to kind of be in this position and in this conversation, especially when they won 4 games a year ago.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
Which little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
I mean, it's just like what you feel like the vibe is around USC coming out of the UCLA game. And I ask that in the sense of like watching that game. I don't have an appreciation in the Midwest for that rivalry. It seemed like both teams really burned a lot of fuel in that game. It was very, very emotional. If you saw the same thing being there, felt the same thing being there, and if that, not that like Notre Dame and USC isn't a rivalry, it is, but it's a different kind of rivalry. Yeah. I don't think that there's like sort of this like local animosity or hatred there. Like, is could in any way USC sort of come out of the UCLA game like a little bit drained just because of how much they put into it?
That's what I was wondering, because it's sandwiched. Like, you have the UCLA game and this Notre Dame game sandwiched between the Pac-12 title game,
right?
And
it's odd, like, it's weird that this is like their least important game of a 3 week stretch, right?
Yeah, so like, and that Pac-12 title game is on a short week, so you know, you're kind of looking to like Oregon and stuff or Utah, and you have this top 15 team that's coming to your place and like would love to spoil your national title, like your college football playoff run. It's a very good roster too. And so like, obviously there's so much attention placed on the UCLA game for about a month. Like, ever since UCLA beat Washington and Utah, those back-to-back weeks, I think USC fans kind of noticed like, hey, this team is going to be trouble. Even though they lost to Oregon, I think that was someone they saw as a very formidable opponent. I think they were concerned about Zach Charbonnet and DTR and what they could do to that defense. So there hasn't been like a ton of talk about Notre Dame just because UCLA was going to be a tough opponent and it was coming up first on the schedule. And I think like there hasn't been a ton of talk about Notre Dame until probably like the past 2 weeks when they played Cal, and Cal didn't have a chance to win, but I think they played them closer than people expected. And then I think people got a little nervous. Like, USC fans are like, are we going to beat UCLA? Are we going to beat Notre Dame? And then I think that's when more attention got placed on those two teams.
I'll go back to the Caleb Williams for a second, Antonio. I'm curious for your perspective, because you're there every day and you've covered this guy since he got there. I get all the hype right now. You know, when he does what he did against UCLA and on that stage, the guy looks like the best player in the country. And, you know, he was first in my votes and a lot of our votes this week's
time. Mine too.
But I mean, I had him too for a while before that. And I wrote a column today that I think endeared me to USC fans and pissed off everyone else, which is essentially why did it take so long for this guy to get so much attention? Because they've played every single game this year at 6 Eastern time or later, only two of which have been in primetime windows with 18 broadcasters. Like, you mentioned the Cal game. Me and Pete were recording the Shamrock after Notre Dame Clemson. I wrote, USC's up big. I go home. 24 hours later, I see Cal almost won. Like, it's, and I'm a guy who follows this closely. Like, I just think the visibility has been terrible. I've got a million people I mentioned saying his schedule sucks and it's much better than Michigan's and it's every bit as bad as Ohio State's. Like, I just think you play Indiana in the big noon kickoff and you have a big game if you're Ohio State. CJ Stroud, he's a Heisman winner. Caleb Williams does not have those opportunities, which dovetails into another conversation we can get to about why they're leaving for the Big Ten. But are you surprised, just seeing how good he's been every week this year, surprised that it kind of took this long and this kind of moment for him to get this kind of attention?
Yeah. Coming into the season, I was so curious about what he could be. He had the big moments at Oklahoma last year, but he also had like the Baylor game and right. The Iowa State game, to where he got really like shut down and slowed down. Then he started off the season hot, and then he had like two quiet games. One was at Oregon State. I think that was his worst game of the year. And then he had 2 weeks later, Washington State kind of slowed him down as well. So I was like, okay, there's still some growing to do there. And then ever since the Utah game, he just took off. I was curious to see how he was going to play that game, because I think Oregon State kind of flustered the offense on the road. I was like, how is he going to handle this road environment at Utah? It was like an emotionally charged night. They're honoring Ty Jordan and Aaron Lowe. This is a good Utah team that's like kind of like fighting for their life in the Pac-12. And he just lit up Utah. That was probably up until last week his best game of the season. And at that point, that was the best team they'd played. And he's just been full go, full steam ahead ever since then. And just like kind of carried this team on his back against an Arizona team that's not very good, but it's kind of plucky. Then beat UCLA and got those wins against Colorado and Cal. And just seeing what he does and how he's kind of carried this offense and just how poised he is. These have been some kind of high pressure situations where he's been pretty much has to score on every drive. He doesn't do it every time, but he does it a lot of the time. And that's what USC needed. I think it's been so impressive just watching him. And he's just playing with a ton of confidence right now.
So when USC's offense bogs down, which is not often, maybe we can go weeks between that happening. And I don't know how applicable you feel like the Oregon State game is anymore. But like watching the UCLA game on Saturday night, I felt like UCLA was trying to get pressure with like a limited pass rush, not blitzing a lot. Like, is it as simple as like you have to get home with four or sometimes three guys? Because it felt like Caleb Williams had a hell of a lot of time back there to just sort of pick apart whatever UCLA was or was not doing. Is that, I mean, if you were trying to defend Caleb Williams, how would you do it? How have you seen teams have even just like this little scintilla of success against him?
I think coming into the year, people thought like drop eight, drop seven, and yeah, you know, live with that and make him beat you. But like, I think teams have tried that and that hasn't, like Utah tried to only rush four and he lit them up and they had to blitz a lot more the rest of the game and they got some pressure. They didn't obviously still put up 42 points, but they got a couple of sacks in some critical situations to where USC could have pulled away, like got up 21, but they kept it at 14 because they got some sacks and things like that. I think Oregon State changed up the looks on him in a pretty good way. And their secondary is really good, probably the best in the Pac-12. There's not a lot of good defenses in the Pac-12 this year, but Oregon State has a legitimately good defense. And so I think you kind of have to switch it up on them. The UCLA interception he had was the worst throw he's made, the worst decision he's made all season. That was kind of surprising to see, just because for as much as he's throwing the ball, he only has three picks. Two have come in the past 2 weeks. So I think just switching up and giving him a variety of looks is kind of the key to trying to slow him down.
It's funny, even that Oregon State game, which, you know, I had to illegally stream and watch late at night on Pac-12 Network here. I know it wasn't his best game, but I feel like in some ways you learn more about him through that than anything else. Cause you know, he takes him down at the end, makes a throw that just looks better with each replay to Jordan Addison to win it at the end there. And I just think it says a lot about the guy and the way he's played so far. The season's been so electric and there's so much at stake for USC in the short term that it probably hasn't gotten as much attention or discussion locally as it would have otherwise. But I'm curious, you know, next time Notre Dame goes out there, this will be, you know, will USC be playing in the Big Ten title game the next week, not the Pac-12 title game? It's still pretty crazy to think about them as a future Big Ten team. What's kind of been the reaction to that move coming in 2 years locally?
I think the fans love it. I think there's a little more hesitation on the UCLA side of things, but USC, I think they're ready. I think they want to go. I think there's always been like you hear like when it's like the slowest point of like every off season, like in May or something, you hear like, should USC go independent and all this stuff? And then so every year, like without fail, you hear something like that. And so I think they've been ready to leave the Pac-12. The late night kicks, the lack of revenue, the officiating, all those factors have had them ready to go for a while. And so when it happened, I think, oh, they're excited. I think they're still excited. I think they still realize there's work that needs to be done to their roster. Like, they need to get better on the defensive line. They need more depth along the offensive line. But I think they know what that money could do for the program in terms of retaining and hiring better coaches and building out your recruiting department and building facilities wherever you can on campus at USC. It's hard, fixing those and kind of improving those. And because, you know, they're expected to compete with the SEC schools and Notre Dame and Ohio State and Michigan. And, you know, the Pac-12 payout, you know, isn't going to really contribute to that. So I think they're ready to go to the Big Ten and get that money and try to be on the upper echelon.
Is it, before getting back to the game, like, What is the sense of the Notre Dame series around there? Like, I know they've said that it's going to continue as, I think, sort of as is. Does that work for, I mean, the Big Ten likes to have sort of conference rivalry week be at the end of the year. That's this week. Big Ten doesn't play a lot of, I think, non-conference games during the conference schedule, which is typically when USC comes out here. Is there a whole lot of talk about how that may or could change?
They haven't talked about it much yet. I know. I'm sure they'd love to keep it, and I think they will, but they haven't talked about how much it'll change yet. And I know that's going to obviously be a big topic of discussion, you know, in a year or two.
One more on that. I asked this in real time and it's become less relevant now as they've gotten really good, really quick. But I always wondered, do you think Lincoln Riley would have taken the job if he knew they were going to the Big Ten? Cause I just feel like he's going to have to recruit so much differently and run a different offense eventually, at least in November, than he's used to doing.
I kind of think he would have, just because, like, you know, well, now it's, I guess you have to weigh, would you want to stay in the SEC with Oklahoma, or would you want to go to, like, the Big Ten with USC, and like, which one would you have more success with? I still think it's probably USC in the Big Ten than Oklahoma in the SEC. So I think he would have.
So, yeah. I mean, as they recruit differently, like you mentioned, sort of the defensive line, what do they not have, like, the horses on defense to be better than they are, or how, like, because they have a very good defensive coordinator. I think that's, like, kind of understood around college football. Where do you think,
not
like,
the biggest fans.
Okay. maybe it's not understood, but like, where are the biggest gaps on that side of the ball? Because they're not just, like, struggling here a little bit. I mean, they've been sort of historically bad.
I think you see it in the defensive front. Okay. They don't have, like, Corey Foreman. He made the play on Saturday night, but this was a guy who was, like, the number one prospect in the country for a majority of the 2021 cycle. Like, he's supposed to be for them what, like, JTT is for Ohio State, and, like, he hasn't been producing or making that sort of impact until Saturday night. And there's just not a lot of big bodies on the defensive line on the West Coast. It's an issue for them and the rest of the Pac-12 schools. So when you have a guy like Corey Foreman, it's imperative to sign him and then for him to develop into, you know, an impact player, and he hasn't. And in that same class, they've had Rajon Davis, who is a top 50 linebacker in the country. He hasn't played much since he arrived 2 years ago. And so those linebacker, it's been a long time since they've had, like, a true impact guy, like the Cushing, Maluga, Clay Matthews days. You know, those are long gone for you.
2006 game, when you're just like, holy crap. I mean, I remember, like, Keith Rivers out there, like, it was just like, to quote Ari Wasserman, is dudes everywhere. It doesn't seem like it's been that way for a while. So it's just like, I mean, you think it's just a lack of volume of guys, not only quality guys, but, like, the quality guys that have hit have turned out to be misses. Like, I think that has been Notre Dame's issue sometimes. Like, they don't have the roster depth where, like, they need their five stars to hit. Like, Michael Mayer can't come here and just be okay. He has to be a stud, or Kyle Hamilton has to be a stud. Like, their version of Hamilton and Mayer just, like, haven't been what they thought they were going to be.
Yeah, exactly. And Clay Helton, he initially did a good job recruiting the defensive line. But then towards the latter years, it slipped, and, you know, that staff wasn't a good recruiting staff, and all the constant hot seat talk didn't help him in any way on the recruiting trail. And I think you see the result of that now when they play defense.
How have they changed the way they operate internally, recruiting wise? And I say that, you know, independent of the transfer portal, which obviously you can't ignore, but when you look at this roster, their best players obviously just came from other schools. When you look at how Lincoln Riley's going to build this thing out long term, what is his approach? Will it be similar to Oklahoma's? Will it be a mix of what he did at Oklahoma and taking advantage of the location he's in right now? How have they got after it on the high school trail?
At Oklahoma, I think that they did a good job of filling their needs and going out nationally when they needed to. I think you're seeing a mix of that and relying on Southern California when the talent's there. Malachi Nelson and Mekhi Lemon are two top 40 guys. Malachi Nelson's like the number three player in the country. So that kind of helps the quarterback and wide receiver need. Then you see them go to Nevada to get Zach Branch, who's a five-star wideout. Go to Louisiana and get a four-star linebacker and beat Ohio State for Tekken Curtis. They've gone to Texas a bunch too for some running backs. It's where this staff has a lot of connections. So I think you've seen them try to get what they can, what they need in Southern California. And then when they have needs elsewhere and they can't fill those in Southern California, then they kind of try to branch out and get those guys from different regions of the country.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I mean, do you expect like the transfer portal activity to be, it's got to be decreased, but like, do you think they'll sort of settle into a happy flow of like 5-6 transfers a year, or do you think it may be a dozen every year moving forward? Like Lincoln Riley just may build his rosters differently than everybody else.
Yeah, I think so. I think it obviously won't be like 20 guys again. Yeah. I think it could see like 10. That'd still be a pretty good amount for them. Right now they have 20 high school kids, but I just think so much is going to change with the elimination of the 25 initial counters. And I think, That's just going to change the way they go about building the roster. I still think they can still take advantage of that rule to where you can basically process kids for, I think he still has a couple of months to where he can take advantage of it. And I think we'll see that in December. And I think you're going to see a lot more transfers coming in. I just think they're going to be a popular destination too. I think wideouts are going to want to play with Caleb Williams next year. There's going to be opportunities for playing time like almost everywhere on defense. And this might be a playoff team, and you know, that's going to be something they can sell in the portal really, really well. And I think they're going to be very, very active again there this year.
So a year ago from the time we'll be covering this game this weekend, Mike Bone and Brandon Zaza were in a suite watching the Big 12 title game, Oklahoma lose, basically high-five themselves thinking they got this guy, and they did. Day after that, Brian Kelly leaves for LSU, each one more shocking than the last. I'm curious from your standpoint, which move surprised you more, USC taking Lincoln Riley from Oklahoma or Brian Kelly leaving Notre Dame for LSU?
I think it was the Lincoln Riley one that surprised me more. Just
really? Wow.
Yeah. I remember like telling someone, like, nobody leaves Oklahoma. Like, I obviously didn't know Lincoln was, you know, going to come to USC, but when the LSU rumors were going on with Lincoln and LSU, I said, he's not going to leave for like LSU. That nobody leaves Oklahoma at all. Like, well, like
leave Notre Dame for LSU.
and so I was like, he's not going to go there. And then when he got hired at USC, I was stunned. But like there was some talk that USC was like talking to Brian Kelly, like not like going to offer him or whatever, but there was like some conversations, like, you know, they were vetting him and like checking him out and like trying to talk to him. So like you kind of knew like maybe he might listen or he was going to be approached by somebody. So I think that made that kind of less surprising to me.
It's funny. It just to piggyback off that, I mean, they have the same agent. He clearly is creating a bidding war with his clients among multiple schools and got them both paid. But that week, I mean, probably a year ago today, maybe it was when Brian Kelly got asked directly about USC because his name kept getting thrown out for that. And he made the definitive statement of like, unless they give me whatever it was, three.
Fairy godmother offer.
Fairy godmother offer. Yeah.
Term he used.
Fairy godmother. He said, this will be my final coaching stop. And, you know, a few days later, that ended up not being true. But I just thought, you know, there was a reason, though, independent of whatever was going on behind the scenes. Like, Pete and I spent a lot of time on the show last year when USC was open. I thought, I didn't think he would leave for anywhere, but I thought if he were to leave, USC would make more sense than where he ended up going, just as far as, you know, city guy. I think he would fit more on the West Coast than he would down South. And you know, he could recruit at his own pace, so to speak. But man, everything just kind of took a flip there with everybody. You know, when we recorded this show with you last year, we were in a far different place, both as Notre Dame reporters and as USC reporters, that's for sure.
Are you guys surprised by LSU season?
This year, yes.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like on both ends of the spectrum, though, like the fact that they got absolutely housed at home by Tennessee surprised me. I think it was like Brian Kelly's worst home loss since he was at Grand Valley State. And that was the kind of game that I thought that he would not leave Notre Dame because he would have to endure a total culture rebuild. Like, I just didn't think he had the energy to do what he's doing. Like, Lincoln Riley, I totally get. Like, he's he may have another move after this one in terms of his career. Brian Kelly, I thought, I kind of took him at his word that he was done. But when someone offers you 10 years for $95 million guaranteed, like, I get it. I do think a lot of Notre Dame fans were, like, jumping up and down when they lost to Florida State, and they really comical way and thought like, haha, like this is going to be a long slog there. But I was surprised he beat Alabama, just because I didn't think that him delivering in big games, like they've had good performances in big games, not the playoff, but like in the regular season, but rarely the do
Georgia
they sort of,
games like
yeah that. They just don't win them. They play well. So to win that was pretty surprising. Kind of like getting into the nitty gritty of this one, like just from an injury report, how healthy or not is USC? Because we talked to Marcus Freeman on Monday, revealed that safety Brandon Joseph is probable with an ankle sprain. He's missed the last 2 weeks, but Cam Hart, their starting corner, is questionable, and usually questionable has meant out this season for Notre Dame. So that is a potential serious blow to Notre Dame secondary. But like from a USC health point of view, how are they heading into this weekend?
I think there's two guys to watch. Receiver Mario Williams. Like Lincoln Riley hasn't been like forthcoming with injury stuff at all this year. But like he tweaked something before the Arizona game, and he missed like three games in a row. And he played a little bit against UCLA last week. It was his first game back. He didn't, like, I don't know if he was on a pitch count or anything, but he just didn't play like the normal amount he usually plays. And he's been like their number two receiver all season. So I wonder with another week if those snaps will increase. And Eric Gentry injured his ankle against Utah. And early in the season, he was like their biggest impact guy. Oh, one of the biggest impact guys on defense, just because I've never seen like another linebacker built like him. He's like 6'6", like 205. So he looks like a receiver. And, but he's totally disruptive in the passing lanes. He's like quarterbacks just like kind of like malfunction when they see him, and they're like, how do I throw it over this guy? And so like he gets his hands on balls and he just like breaks stuff up. Or like,
I just want to stop you there. Drew Pine has like 3 batted passes every week because he's 5'10". So he may throw it into like his chest protector. This is a bit like of a matchup problem for Notre Dame, frankly.
I won't lie. You looked like you were looking at your phone when you said, "I'm going to stop you right there." And you said, "Drew Pine." I thought you were going to say, "Stop the show." Drew Pine just got hurt or transferring or something. It was going to happen.
No, just like this. I've sort of have a running Twitter joke of tip pass of the week where I put a little trademark on the tweet because like he's good for usually two every week. And when you have a shorter quarterback who can't see over the line and you're talking about a 6'5" linebacker coming in, that could be a matchup problem for Notre Dame. But like outside beyond that, like the other injury guys, I mean, you said those were the two big guys. Other than that, are they fairly healthy?
They're fairly healthy. I think Gentry will still be like, he came back against UCLA, but only played like one series and it looked like his ankle was still bothering him. So I think that's going to be like the biggest one to watch to see if he can play or if he can play more this week. But everyone else health-wise is pretty good for USC at this point. At least I think it's generally about as good as you can ask for from a health standpoint for them at this point.
Very, very important question. I can't believe it took us 38 minutes to get into this. How is USC's punt protection team? Because Notre Dame has been phenomenal at blocking punts this year.
Oh, where's John Baxter? Bring him back.
Do they punt USC? I guess this should be the first question. But
they didn't punt until like 2 minutes left in the game on Saturday. And like that like was very close to being blocked. And like I've paid attention to Notre Dame, but like I haven't watched like every game, and like I know like the punt blocks have been like a thing, and so USC don't have a special teams coordinator, and like they don't have like a dedicated special teams coach. They have an analyst who helps. I think a lot of the assistants just pitch in and stuff. Like the special teams will do some like mind-numbing stuff sometimes.
What was that like squib kick on Saturday night? I was just baffled by that. Made no sense.
Exactly. They did it twice on Saturday, and the first time they did it, UCLA scored like 6 plays immediately after, and then they did it in the fourth quarter, and like the kicker didn't kick it as far as he was supposed to. So UCLA started like their 45-yard line, and they scored like 1 play like immediately after. So like all the fans were pissed, and then. The kicker missed 2 field goals. The kickoff return unit hasn't been great this season. The punter was like brought in from Australia like in August. So like it's been like not the best year for USC special teams. They've actually had some moments where they've been good, but for the most part, I think they've been kind of underwhelming. So that's definitely like an aspect I'm going to be watching on Saturday.
I was going to say, they have not had 1 blocked yet. So maybe there's a first time for everything. But like the fact that their punter's last name is Sleep, I don't know. Maybe they'll
Sleepy.
There's a lot of puns to be had there if Notre Dame gets them. And like, yeah, I feel like perhaps there will be some Broyles Award snub motivation here since Brian Mason was on the list, Notre Dame's special teams coordinator, but did not make the semifinalist, but I believe USC's defensive line coach did, if I'm not mistaken. I think that it does feel like I don't feel like it's a game where Notre Dame has to score a non-offensive touchdown to win, but it does seem like one where they're going to have to make an explosive play outside of the norm. And I guess like in terms of USC's defense, like we talked about some of their personnel issues a little bit or their development issues, just like schematically, like where do teams get them? Is it inside zone runs? Is it play action passes? Like it more is like deep shot 50-50 balls? Like where do you get them if you're an opposing offense?
I think it's more attacking like the edges with the run game. Okay. UCLA, I don't think they did it enough. They try to attack USC like in the interior. And Zach Charbonnet was tackled for loss, like surprisingly, like a 3 times in the second half. But whenever they had runs to the edge or DTR was like lead blocking, those plays always went for 10, 20 yards. And I think that's where you can attack USC. they've been worse in, with the pass, just like in the seams over the middle of the field. I think their fan, USC's fans have been like panicking about Michael Mayer since like the Utah game, because Dalton Kincaid had like 16 catches for like 234 yards against USC. And they've been like panicking about Michael Mayer. Like, this one's been like circled like for a long, long time. Like, no tight end is really like, well, UCLA actually, their tight end scored three times, but it wasn't like, those were all like red zone play action plays. But they've been worried about like this matchup and with Michael Mayer for almost a month and a half now.
Oh, wow. I thought you were exaggerating, but he really did have six. Dalton Kincaid really did have 16 catches for 234 yeah. yards.
Well, I don't think that, to your point, I don't see Notre Dame getting into or winning a shootout. But yeah, someone told me a stat today, and I wasn't sure if it was true or not. And sure enough, it's on page one of the game notes. But Notre Dame's on a 5-game streak of 35 or more points. Anyone want to guess the last time they did that?
1940s.
1943. They've never done it in six straight games, and I think they might have to do it in this one. I am curious, you know, you mentioned Mayer. I was surprised, pleasantly surprised, at how well USC was able to run without Travis Dye last week. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that's sustainable? I mean, UCLA and Notre Dame run defense is pretty comparable statistics-wise. I think Notre Dame's a little bit more physical, but what do you expect from them without Dye this week?
Yeah, they didn't really miss a beat without him. And I thought that was surprising because he was so big for what they did short yardage wise and everything like that. But Austin Jones was good earlier in the season. He just lost a lot of reps throughout the course of this season because his pass protection wasn't as good as Travis Dye's. Travis Dye really gained that role because he was a great pass blocker for Caleb Williams, and he bailed him out on a ton of throws throughout the season. So I didn't expect much change in the run game. I expected that to impact the pass game more, but it really didn't. And I think Austin Jones brings more as a receiver out of the backfield than Dye did. But it didn't, like, his pass protection and his issues there didn't hurt them against UCLA, which was kind of surprising because UCLA can get after the quarterback a little bit.
This is kind of my last question, but I was interested in like the atmosphere on Saturday, because like it's been hostile to the home team in this series, I think, the last few times I've been out there, for like kind of obvious reasons, or it's been apathetic. But I do remember, I've been doing this long enough that I remember covering the 2002 game out there and the 2006 game out there when USC was good and Notre Dame was good, and it being really hostile and not sort of like this getaway weekend for Notre Dame fans who live in California. Like, it was not a place where you just, like, if you were a fan wearing Notre Dame gear, like, head on a swivel. Like, what's the atmosphere been like so far this season in the Coliseum? Has it been renovated? Like, it's kind of, I would assume, a different vibe there. And like, so what's kind of your expectation for the atmosphere on Saturday?
I'm really curious to see what it's going to be like. It's been energetic at the Coliseum this season, but they've been like 65,000 people. It's like a 77,000 seat stadium now after the renovation. It's been energetic, and obviously, but they haven't had like a marquee, like, home opponent. They had like Washington State, who was like, okay, they're like 4-1 at the time, but they weren't like a top 25 team. They had Fresno State when Jake Kaner was still healthy early in the season, but that's, you know, Fresno State. So they haven't had like another, you know, powerhouse come in there yet. And I want to see what it's like this weekend, because like the Rose Bowl, you know, I had the tarps on, but there's still 70,000 people, like, that was filled. And I think Lincoln Riley took notice of that. And he mentioned after the game, like, West Coast football was like alive and well. And he basically alluded to, like, you know, I want to see more of this, like, on the West Coast, where, you know, the environment's like it was in the Rose Bowl on Saturday night.
And yeah, it's interesting. I was just looking at the ticketing for this. Like, it's not sold out, but it's going to be. I mean, it's like the seating map makes it look like there's about 75 tickets available for this game. So I mean, that will be a sellout. For it seems like it has a chance to be a great atmosphere.
Yeah, it was like, I think him saying that was kind of like a call to action to like the USC fans, like, hey, we have this team, like, support us. So I'm curious to see what that atmosphere is going to be like on Saturday, because I've been covering this team since 2018, and, you know, this should be the best atmosphere, I think, they've had in the Coliseum, you know, since then.
I'll let you out of here. If you want to make a prediction, go for it. If you don't, we could save it for your print product on Friday. But USC will lose this game if...
if they get manhandled on the line of scrimmage on defense. I think that'll... because they've been able to stop teams enough. They stopped Oregon State enough. They stopped UCLA enough to force those quarterbacks to pass, and those quarterbacks are able to make mistakes. They stopped Utah enough, but Cam Rising was good enough to make them pay in the passing game. I think if they can't stop the run, I think it's going to be major trouble. I think USC will win, but I still think it'll be a close, competitive game.
Yeah, I'm fascinated to sort of see if Notre Dame can kind of control the pace a little bit. Like, I could definitely see, like, if the game's in the 20s, I think Notre Dame will win. I could see Notre Dame maybe winning if it's in the 30s. If it's in the 40s, that's sort of when the train has left the station a little bit for Notre Dame offensively, unless we're talking about punt blocks and stuff. But, yeah, it should be a very fun atmosphere. I'm looking forward to getting out there for reasons other than the snow outside of my office. Mm-hmm. And Matt will be out there joining me. So, Antonio, we'll see you Saturday night at the Coliseum in the press box. Thanks for making some time for us on the Shamrock to go pretty deep on the Trojans. And if any of our listeners want to read more on USC, you can check out Antonio's stuff on The Athletic. I really liked his piece earlier in the year on sort of USC kind of becoming a little bit of a villain again in college football. And we talked about that at the top of the show with sort of... you know, the transfer portal and NIL and coaching changes and all that. So plenty of good USC material on The Athletic too for you to check out. So, Antonio, thanks again. We'll see you on Saturday night. He's Matt. I'm Pete. Thanks for being with us on the latest episode of The Shamrock.